Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. On Book Spectrum, we talk with both seasoned and new authors from several professions across the spectrum. It can be amazing how one little mistake or decision can change one's life and perhaps history. An unopened letter, mishearing something, screwing up orders, an impromptu postponement, all seemingly small, but have the potential to redirect either better or worse outcomes. With me on this edition of Book Spectrum is Jared Knott, who compiled a library of destiny-changing little mishaps throughout the centuries in his new book, Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. Welcome to Book Spectrum, Jared.
Good to be here. Great honor. Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. These are the kinds of things many of us think about, the what-ifs in life. What inspired you to write a book about those?
Yes, it actually comes from the old adage that comes down through Benjamin Franklin and others that for want of the nail, the shoe was lost. For want of the shoe, the rider was lost. For want of the rider, the battle was lost. For want of the battle, the empire was lost. The empire was lost, all for the want of a nail. But how often does that really happen, that a single tiny mistake causes an entire empire to collapse? You'll be amazed how often this happened over and over again. Would you like an example?
Well, why not? There are several in the book. Let's grab one.
Mm-hmm. I can start. Yeah, I'll throw one in here. A single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction changed the outcome of the Vietnam War. The United States might very well have won, except for this single tiny mistake, which doesn't make any sense, does it? A single piece of tape, what are we talking about? It had to do with the Watergate break-in. The burglars were told to hold down the striker on the door from the parking garage to the office with a single piece of tape in the vertical position. They made a mistake, and they put it in the horizontal position. So the night watchman, Frank Wills, came walking by. What's this? Tape on the door. He sees that the door has been jimmied, calls the police. Okay. The police originally called for a uniformed officer who was on duty to go out there and check it out. But the rumor has it that the officer was drunk in a local bar. Okay. So they had to send the bum patrol, officers dressed as hobos in a sloppy car. So they were not recognized by the lookout as police officers. They go in there, and if they recognized him earlier, he was walkie-talkie, he would have warned them to get out of the building. But they arrest James McCord and the burglars. Watergate, boom, boom, boom. Nixon administration collapses. And Henry Kissinger said that they knew that the North Vietnamese were going to be testing the treaty. The plan was to go in there and bomb the daylights out of them again to get them back into compliance. They were so weak politically they couldn't. South Vietnam collapses, Nixon administration collapses, it all falls apart because of a single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction.
And adding to that, we might not have had our favorite or one of my favorite radio talk shows, the G. Gordon Liddy Show. So
right.
Things happen.
That's right. He'd been a different profession. Yeah, that was the case. A very unusual individual.
He's sort of a Renaissance man, but he became a celebrity after all of that.
Mm-hmm. And it made his name very big, and I'm sure he's made a huge amount of money off all the publicity all these years. He was a very tough guy. And a very serious operative and very committed to the administration, but he was on the wrong side of history.
Well, that's what it seems to be what you're saying with the book. A small blunder can snowball into a huge success or disaster or something else. That's covered in the book all over the place, kind of like that butterfly effect.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that there's actually the butterfly expression is used two different ways in the book. The first one is from a mathematician, Dr. Lorenz. And he talked about how in weather, he was surprised that just a tiny, tiny little bitty change in the beginning of a progression can actually lead to huge results 6 months later. He exaggerated a little bit, but he said a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil can lead to a cyclone in Texas, 8 or 9 months later. That's a little bit of an overstatement, but that's actually what happens in the weather, and it can happen in history as well. One domino hitting another, and someone like that, it creates a huge disaster in the end. Now, the other use of the word butterfly has to do with the butterfly ballot, okay? Let me tell you about that. And that was in Palm Beach County in the 2000 election. A lady named Teresa Lepore, I'm sure a very nice lady, was a clerk of elections, and she wanted to make sure that the older people down there had big print so they could read the ballot. So she designed a ballot that was two pages, had a series of punch holes down the center, and they had candidates on the left side of the page, the left page, candidates on the right page. Well, Al Gore was the number two name on the left side of the page, but he was the three punch hole. The number two punch hole was on the other side of the page, and that was Pat Buchanan. Well, Pat Buchanan, a smaller candidate. It was expected to get maybe in the surrounding counties, he got 100 or 200 or 300 votes, something like that. This particular election, he got way over 2,000 votes. Okay, and plus a lot of people double punch. They punch Al Gore's name and they punch his name, both for Pat Buchanan. They got double punched and they had like 5,000 ballots thrown out altogether. So it's very clear that people meant to vote for Al Gore, but actually vote for Pat Buchanan or double voted. And Al Gore lost the state of Florida by like 537 votes. He lost the election. He would have been president of the United States. He was adamantly opposed to the war in Iraq. The war would never have taken place. All that would never happen except for that tiny little poorly designed ballot. And they had Teresa Lepore on one of the morning talk shows. They're saying to her, people are saying that you're responsible for the election of George Bush in this election. You're responsible for this war. And she was kind of in tears. Okay, you're crying, lady, but we have over 200,000 people dead and $2 trillion in debt because of your mistake. Aha.
Well, we wouldn't be talking about that if Gore could carry his own home state, which he didn't. So that's another thing.
That's right. He lost his state of Tennessee. You're right.
Right. I do remember Pat Buchanan, though, polling very well in that county. And in an interview later on, he said, well, if I didn't really get those votes, I don't really want them. But there was a controversy over that, too. There were a lot of things. I'm not sure if we could blame that woman, but there were a lot of issues with that election that could have gone either way and changed history. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But then again, who knows if the September 11th attacks would have happened. That could have been handled differently, and we don't even know what would have happened after that. And that's another direction we could have taken.
Sure, of course, you never know. It's all going to be. Conceivably, the terrorists would not have attacked if it had been Al Gore, although I think they would have, and a lot of things would have turned out the same way. But we would not have been in the war in Iraq. He was just, Al Gore, to his credit, was just adamantly opposed to the war, so that's one thing that would have gone a different direction. And so, of course, we don't have a magic time machine. We cannot go back and change things. Once they're done, they're done.
Of course, he could have gone back and changed his predictions when the polar ice caps were going to melt in, what, 2006 or 2008? He provided a lot of fun over the years. So
I don't want to get into that too deeply, but yes, a lot of the predictions that have been made in that category have turned out to be completely wrong. But I'll leave that alone.
But again, everything snowballs. We may not have had him doing this sort of thing, and history could have gone into 17 different directions even after that. And that's what's amazing about the whole thing. Jared Nutt is with me on Book Spectrum. His book is Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. Mistakes amongst the powerful individuals are common throughout your book. While they have obvious ramifications, small players, the little guys, can greatly affect history with their own slip-ups. Let's get into some of the lesser-known history-changing ball droppers you discuss.
Okay. Yeah, there's one, and the teaser is that a soldier accidentally kicks a helmet off the top of a wall, okay, and that leads to the collapse of an entire empire, okay, and that had to do with Cyrus the Great, which was perhaps the first real large conqueror in history. He's mentioned in praiseworthy terms in the Bible, and he was fighting Croesus, and Croesus is known expression, rich as Croesus, a very wealthy emperor, and he was laying siege to his city, and Croesus had the support of the Spartans. Okay, they fought to kind of a draw, and then Croesus decided, Cyrus the Great decided to withdraw. So he put his troops back on the ships, sails away, okay? And then, okay, they won, and so the Spartans pack up and they leave, but they did not call him Cyrus the Great for nothing, because he sailed away and then he came back, okay? And they sent word to the Spartans, please come back because he's laying siege to us again. So there they were, and winter was coming on, it was in the fall. How long is this going to last? How successful is this going to be? Well, some soldier on the top of the wall there, one of Croesus's troops, accidentally kicks a helmet off the top of the wall. It was coming down the side of the wall, okay? And the man has a pathway. He walks down the side of the wall, goes all the way down to near the bottom, finds his helmet, walks all the way back up. Well, the soldiers of Cyrus the Great, they see this. Oh, hey, there's a pathway up the side of the wall. And they see it and they record it. And that night or the next night, shortly thereafter, they have a raiding party that walks up that pathway up the side of the wall, comes up over the top of the wall, overpowers the guards, goes over and opens up the gates. And then Cyrus's troops come pouring in and the city falls. And Croesus was either put to death, okay, by one version, or he was accepted with open arms from Cyrus, take your pick. Being cynical, I think maybe he just burned at the stake. But anyway, that one little mistake, okay, caused the entire empire to collapse.
There's always that saying, leave no stone unturned.
Right.
And be careful with everything. Hold on to everything tight. Don't kick things around.
That's right.
Something bad could happen.
Right. That's right. So it's on top of a wall. One of my favorites in the book is here's the teaser, and that is a man who is president of a nation who is commanding a large army in the field. When the expected attack from the enemy came, he was in his tent, high in opium, cavorting with a beautiful young slave woman. The battle led to the founding of a new nation, okay, and a famous song was later written about the beautiful young woman. Uh-huh. Okay, and that is Santa Anna at the Battle of San Jacinto. And he had, his background story is he, in 1834, canceled the Constitution and declared himself a dictator. And all seven states in the Mexico, the nation of Mexico, rose up in rebellion. Okay. And he went around systematically for 2 years crushing the rebellion quite with great cruelty in all of the six states south of the Rio Grande. And after they were all put in place and destroyed and a lot of blood, now it's time to cross the Rio Grande and go after the Norte Americanos up there in the provincial government of Texas. So he moves up there, and of course, Alamo was a massacre. Goliad was a massacre. There were several other smaller battles. There were a massacre. It was everything was going his way. He had not lost a battle in like two and a half years. And there's something called victory disease that you see taking place throughout history, where conquerors get a little bit over self-confident. They get a little bit too reckless. They get a little bit too presumptive in that they're going to win automatically. And he took his troops and spread them out in, I think, four or five different columns all the way across Texas. And he was pursuing just the largest of the group with a smaller group of his soldiers, getting kind of sloppy, getting kind of reckless. And he was following Sam Houston and his 700 soldiers. He had like 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers pursuing Sam Houston. And Sam Houston kept retreating. His men, a lot of noisy, kind of rebellious type men, were calling him a coward, wanting to stand and fight. His big political rival, David Burnett, sent him a message: "Sir, the enemy is laughing you to scorn. You must fight." Okay, but he kept retreating. He had a lot of mutiny about the purge taking place. He dug two graves and he said, "Okay, these graves will be filled with mutineers." Okay, so anyway, he managed to keep things under control. And then finally, up there close to what is, well, close to what is now Houston, San Jacinto battlefield, Santa Anna makes a big mistake. He goes out into an area where his water is surrounded by water on three different sides and has a Texican army on the other side. Again, kind of sloppy, not paying much attention. And so the Santa Anna is sitting, and they see the troops over there, Sam Houston's troops. They expect him to attack at dawn. And his own soldiers expect him to attack at dawn. No, he did not attack at dawn. In fact, he slept late that morning. Okay?
Oh, boy.
And he had a meeting with his officers. What's going on? Let's go fight. Were you a coward? And he just listened to him and then walked away. And then one of his key men, Hawkins, came up to him and said, "General, if you could just tell the men what your plans are, I think it would be, make a peaceful atmosphere here in camp." He said, "No, if I did that just for the safety of, just for the convenience of having a pleasant atmosphere around camp, I'd be a worse enemy of Texas than Santa Anna." So anyway, finally, 3:30 in the afternoon, to a surprise, everyone's surprise, he calls his army into battle formation and marches on the enemy. And there was a pipe player that was playing one tune there in the background, probably only the tune he knew. "Come to my bower and lie down with me. Come to my bower shaded by the tree. There in the roses, the lilacs will lie. You'll have a blush in your cheek, but a smile in your eye." Anyway, surprise was total and complete, okay? The Texans had the advantage of long rifles that were rifled at great accuracy. They also had their bowie knives. And here's the key question, why did he wait till 3:30 in the afternoon? We have a very intelligent audience out there. Why not attack at dawn? Well, what was going on with the Mexican army at 3:30 in the afternoon? And the answer is siesta. Sam Houston had intelligence, a good reason to believe that in the siesta period, security in the Mexican army fell down to zero, okay? And that's when he attacked, caught them literally with their pants down. Santa Anna came out of his tent, rubbing his eyes, wearing red carpet slippers, And he called for his trumpeter, sound assembly. I've been shot, Generalissimo. Called for his drummer to beat for assembly. I've been shot also, Generalissimo. And here came one of his best divisions, a big retreat. He jumps on a black horse and rides away. And he was in the tent with a lady, Emily Morgan. Okay, she was a mulatto slave woman. She was, it's an old-fashioned word, she was of Hispanic and African heritage, and she was the Yellow Rose of Texas. And that's the story of how the state of Texas, the nation of Texas, came into being.
A happy blunder for us, a miserable miscalculation for the other side. That kind of happens throughout history. But you do bring up a point, hubris. You brought that up, and that's a trait of some of history's most notorious leaders from ancient times into today. It's been the root of some of history's major blunders. You brought up one, but it's something we can all learn from, even on the job or as a driver or at home.
Yes, in fact, the title of that particular chapter is Victory Disease on the Texas Frontier, and I cite George Armstrong Custer and also MacArthur and also Napoleon as people who suffer from that overconfidence that comes from a series of victories and finding the people overreach and they get themselves into big trouble.
Yeah, MacArthur wanted to get into China. I remember that. That was a huge deal. And the UN was going to win that war, the Korean War.
Yes. They kind of stopped, I guess the 38th parallel, but he got permission to cross over into what was North Korea. They did not just stop it. The original borderline, they went beyond that and were threatening to take over North Korea as well as just defend South Korea. That's when the Chinese poured hundreds of thousands of troops in. That changed everything. But and it's a long story, but finally Matthew Ridgway, MacArthur brought in as his field commander, did a very effective job in turning the tide of the war back in the other direction. But if it would not have been for Matthew Ridgway, there would not be a South Korea.
You're listening to Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. I'm talking with Jared Knott, the author of Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes, which changed the world forever. Jared, the first thing we discussed was possibly winning the Vietnam War, the Watergate situation, the piece of tape.
Mm-hmm.
But we may not have been talking about that because you also bring up in the book personality and family upbringing being major factors in how powerful people make decisions and policy. And as much as some Americans treat and worship the Kennedy family as a substitute for royalty as European celeb lovers have, your book documents how the Kennedy family drama could be what gave rise to Lyndon Baines Johnson, who wound up getting into the Vietnam War, which started a whole set of tumultuous events within our own borders, and pushing legislation which may have been arguably more reasonably established had JFK not been killed, and the presidential baton passing would have taken a different turn.
Absolutely. Yes, it's there's no more powerful family during that era, of course, than the Kennedy family, and no more glamorous family either. And it's a series of events, one leading to another, ended up changing who would be president of the United States in 1960. Let me digress just for a moment. You mentioned Lyndon Johnson being president. This is a kind of a side tidbit here, but I think there were two wars, my personal expression of opinion here, two wars in the last 60 years that we could have avoided. One was the war in Vietnam, and the other one was the war in Iraq. In both cases, we had a Texan as president, and I'm from Texas, and I volunteered for the Vietnam War, and I volunteered for the infantry, blah, 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 that sort of thing. There's something about Texans and war, okay? Both of those wars could have been avoided. Both those wars should have been avoided. If we had a president from Wisconsin or from Delaware or from Minnesota or something like that, it could be that we would just stepped aside and finessed it, and so that never took place. But that's I just kind of a little aside there. But getting back to the Kennedys, John Kennedy was the younger brother, of course, Joe Jr. Joe Jr. Was the he was captain of the Harvard football team. He graduated cum laude from Harvard. I wasn't going to Harvard Law School. I was in World War II became a Navy pilot and was flying planes in Europe. And then his brother became, of course, a PT commander. And as a series of small mistakes that John Kennedy made, he did not have somebody down in the chart room where the radio was located when a warning came through that a Japanese cruiser was heading their direction and it might be in trouble, need to get out of the way. Well, no one was there to take the message, but okay. So that led to the Japanese cruiser cutting the PT-109 in half, Okay, one man was killed and a man was badly wounded. Anyway, long story, but he became a hero. If it had been you and I, maybe we would have been court-martialed. Douglas MacArthur said that John Kennedy should have been court-martialed for losing his boat the way he did, then later denied having said it. But anyway, he was given the Navy Medal, and also there was father's influence, huge amount of publicity, and the big headlines there in the Boston paper, Kennedy's son, hero in the Pacific. Reader's Digest ran big articles on it, you know, at the behest of Joe Kennedy's senior. And so anyway, so a huge amount of jealousy in the rivalry between the two brothers. Never in existence had Joe Kennedy Jr. had to play second fiddle to his brother, very resentful. So there he's over there in Europe flying, I think, B-25s, and as yet he's going to get maybe just a service medal and not any kind of a medal for heroics. And so he volunteers for this suicide mission, okay, to bomb the V-3 plant. It was a compulsion cannon plant in France. The plan was to fire a missile every 3 minutes into London. Okay, they had the V1, which is the buzz bomb, which is already hitting London. Had the V2, which is a supersonic rocket, which is hitting London. And the idea was to fire these rockets every 3 minutes. Churchill said if it had become operational, it would have been the most damaging of the three different kinds of vengeance weapons. But anyway, the idea was they had a plane loaded with explosives, okay, and had television cameras on it. But the two pilots would be on the plane to take it off because it couldn't take off by itself. They would parachute in. Then it would take over the controls with the television cameras and fly the plane filled with explosives into the V1, V3 location there in France. Okay. Well, it may have been an electronic harness, the take two. Joe Kennedy Jr. was warned by an officer that the electronic harness may have been defective. Okay. I did not heed the warning. No one knows exactly what happened, but some spark set off explosives. The entire plane was just vaporized, and that was the end of a man who had a very promising career. He was to be the one that ran for Congress, and at the end of the war, he was the one to go on to become senator. He was the one that would run for president in 1960. All of that changed because of the civic rivalry between the two brothers, very influential and very promising life lost to no purpose.
This kind of thing has gone on for centuries, too, when it comes to royalty and when it comes to powerful leaders and powerful families since ancient times as well. But the Kennedys are the ones that are more relatable. And if you look at modern history, it all depends the way one brother governs versus the way the other one does. And of course, whichever way the other brother might have lost to Richard Nixon in the television debate, too. And then that could have changed another million things.
That's right. You don't know what's going to happen because it's just all speculation. He might have decided to become a brain surgeon instead and not go into politics. We don't know. One thing, by the way, going back into that story, one thing that really set him off, he was home from the Navy going to his father's birthday party. He was dressed in his Navy whites, you know, a very nice looking, striking figure. And in the middle of the big dinner there, a friend of the family stands up for a toast and says, "I want to propose a toast to the hero of the Kennedy family, John Kennedy, okay, hero in the South Pacific." Well, here it is in front of his brother, just boiling over with jealousy. And that night, someone's sleeping in the same room with Joe Jr., and he said he was opening and closing his hands, crying, saying, "I'll show them, I'll show them." It wounded him deeply, and Rose Kennedy in her book said, he had never been behind his brother in anything, and it must have rankled him severely. So that emotional decision was something that had huge consequences for literally generations to come. So go ahead.
Now, Jared, I don't want our listeners on Book Spectrum here to think your book is all doom and gloom and everybody making stupid mistakes and dropping the ball and everything falls apart.
Right.
There are a lot of good results from these mistakes, too, and you do cover these. One of them, and it's quite famous, but it's important to note, Alexander Fleming discovering penicillin by leaving bread out by accident. A little momentary carelessness goes a long way.
Yes, he had a reputation for keeping kind of a sloppy lab, okay, which ordinarily would be a bad thing, but it led to, and I'm sure you're not want to admit to that, but it led to the contamination of one of his cultures, and he noticed, of course, that the bacteria around that particular, it was a penicillin mold that you find on bread, very common, killed the bacteria around it. Okay, there must have been something in that mold that had the ability to ward off and to exterminate surrounding bacteria. So he and it took 9 years of further development to extract the essence of it that could be made into a usable medicine. But that was saved, by the way, it came in 1942 when it was finally developed, right at the beginning of World War II, and saved tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives. It was the first time that the doctors could really treat somebody and really cure somebody. And especially in the beginning, before there was the microbes had a chance to develop immunity, it was extremely effective, very effective, by the way, in treating syphilis, along with a lot of other infections and diseases. And it was a major, major breakthrough as a result of a sloppy lab.
Jared, regular people who are listening and will be reading your book and learn a bit from it. We all make mistakes, but perhaps we could be more wary of some of them, depending on what's at stake. But also, we could take our mistakes and turn them into something positive.
Yes, that's correct. I'll give you, talking about the positive, I mentioned in the book there a book by Atul Gawande, okay, who is a physician, and he wrote a book called The Checklist Manifesto, and it had to do with some good things rising out of mistakes in a way. He was talking about mortality rates in the operating rooms were high, sometimes based on one little thing that went wrong, one little thing that wasn't done right, sometimes based on not being well prepared at just the right time and just the right way. And so there's great complexity in dealing with operations and so on and so forth. He's wondering, well, how does the airline industry, how do pilots deal with the great complexity of flying an airplane? And he went over and spoke with the people at Boeing. How do you deal with all this complexity? And they went back to a famous airline crash, a famous airplane crash, in 1935. It was the forerunner of the Flying Fortress, the B-17. At that time, it was called the B-99. And they had two very good pilots on it. One pilot in particular, the main pilot, was famous and was considered one of the very best test pilots that Boeing had. But in the operation of the plane, they forgot one little thing. They forgot to throw the switch on the, I think it was the elevator yoke, which is turning off the automatic pilot. Just one little switch was not thrown. Well, that forced the nose of the plane up. It stalled. The airplane pancaked down. Both pilots were killed. Some of the people in the back escaped, but both of the pilots were killed. And so they did an analysis there at Boeing. What can we do to prevent these mistakes in these complex planes? They went back to an ancient tool, okay, the humble checklist. And they put together a checklist that would maybe have 35, 40 items on it, and that the pilot and co-pilot would go through each one. Throw such and such a switch, check, check. Turn the dial to such and such a position, check, check. Turn off the elevator yoke, check, check. They go down this thing to make sure every single one of these things is done. Human beings can only think about one thing at a time. You have to make sure that you go to each one of the different stations that have to be done in terms of your thought and make sure that a function is performed. Otherwise, it can be tragedy. Well, okay, then Atul Gawande brought that principle, that basic, humble, but very, very effective principle back to the operating room. We need to have a checklist here also. And they put it into effect. What they also noticed, by the way, that when everybody in the operating room introduced themselves to everybody else, everybody knew everybody's name, fatalities also dropped because people were more willing to speak up, more willing to communicate, more willing to work as a team. But anyway, they got dramatically better results as a result of the checklist and also better communication. 36% drop in fatalities in the operating room. Now that system is the standard throughout the United States and throughout the world. They have something called a timeout. They stop. They go through all these checklists before they begin and go forward. But it made a huge, huge difference just making sure that you had all the details lined up and you went off on a checklist to make sure everything was done the way it should have been. And so that's something that out of pain and out of some failure came a major breakthrough.
Jared Nutt with me on Book Spectrum. The book, Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. Jared, you have an interesting background on your own. You served in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You're a decorated Vietnam veteran. You also wrote about Arctic exploration. That's not exactly a place where anyone wants to make any mistakes now.
Right. That's right. Yes, there was talking about Captain Scott and the Lost Exhibition there. That was it's not in the book exactly, but it's a case where there was not really good planning and not really good forethought to the way things were put together. There's a big rivalry between Scott and Amundsen as who was going to get to the South Pole first. And Amundsen won, but then later when he found out that Scott had perished there, he said, well, he wins because he's now a martyr and he will get more exposure and publicity than I would. When someone dies at a lost cause, they become a kind of a special martyr to that cause and get a lot of exposure and publicity and celebrity. But yes, that was kind of a sad story. I don't think the planning was quite what it should have been in that particular case. Let me, if I may, throw in another one. There was a near miss mistake, okay, and that was. And something called Operation Giant Tube. And the way it worked was this. The Italians were communicating with the Allies. They wanted to change sides. They wanted to quit the Nazis and join the Allies after the invasion, successful invasion of Sicily. And so there was this big operation put together. They were going to fly gliders into near Rome, okay, with about 3,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne. And the Italian army was then going to join them, okay? And they were going to attack the German troops there in Rome, take over Rome, and flip the sides from one side to the other. Well, the Germans were no fools, and they got wind of what was going on, and so they withdrew all the gasoline from the Italians and made a very restricted situation where they didn't have much ability to function. And Then, Matthew Ridgway, okay, who was in charge of the 82nd Airborne, was very suspicious of the whole thing. He thought it was kind of a harebrained, cockeyed scheme, and he kept going into his superior, saying, I don't think it's going to work, I don't think it's going to work, almost to the point of insubordination. Finally, he got permission from Eisenhower to send Maxwell Taylor, okay, who was a man who spoke several languages, a brilliant general officer there. He was the artillery officer under Ridgway. He got permission to send him in as disguised as a PO, POW, and they could slip in and talk to the Italians, double check, make sure everything is going to go the way it was planned. Well, okay, Maxwell Taylor, another officer, do get in to Rome. They do get to meet with the president of Italy and talk with the Italians. Turns out the Italians were digging on the whole plan. Okay, they were going to be there. They wanted to cancel the whole thing. Wanted to have nothing to do with it, even though they promised earlier that they would. And on top of that, the Germans had major units in that area. They had armored tanks there, grenadier battalions there, and the airborne would have been there just with the rifles and hand grenades and machine guns, no heavy weapons at all. It was going to turn into a horrible massacre, okay? And then Maxwell Taylor sent a message back, finally sent very key words, situation innocuous, which meant that the entire operation should be canceled, okay? So word gets back to Eisenhower. Eisenhower is furious. He gets a pencil out, he's got to write a note to the Italians, and he breaks the pencil. He's so angry. Gets another pencil, starts writing, breaks the pencil again. Okay, just absolutely a complete rage. He was a man, by the way, known for his very short temper. So anyway, they managed at the very last second to cancel the operation. The Pathfinder planes were already in the air. The other big carrier planes carrying the troops were out there on the tarmac. The general was running out there. So the general there in charge, waving his hands, don't go. And they managed to cancel it just at the last minute. Okay, so a lot of men who would have been perished, who would have been lost, got to live to be fathers and grandfathers, and the disaster was avoided. It might have had a major impact on Eisenhower's career, such a fiasco that was getting ready to take place. But it came within a whisker of being one of the biggest mistakes of World War II.
Jared, what would you like people to take away most from this book?
Yes, it's, if you go to tinyblundersbigdisasters.com, okay, tinyblundersbigdisasters.com, that's the website, and there's some fun things there. We have a fun book trailer. We also have a portrait gallery, which is very interesting. And it's a fun book. History can be fun. It's not just a lot of dry figures and a lot of dry events, such and such election, such and such a date. No, there's a lot of personalities, a lot of conflicts between personalities taking place there. And it can be intriguing. It can be as intriguing as any Hollywood movie. So history can be fun. And I hope I enjoyed writing the book very much. I think people enjoy reading it very much and tell their friends about it.
Once again, the book is Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters, 39 Mistakes That Changed the World Forever. Jared Knott, thank you for joining us here on Book Spectrum.
I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for your probing questions.
You can find the book on Amazon, and you can find a link to Jared's website and our book on our website, bookspectrum.com. Once again, I'm Chris Cordani. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.